In this session, we talk about the Babylonians, which means that we're getting closer to the end of the Old Testament era. More specifically, we talk about the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Neo, of course, means what? New. Or it's a renewed. It was the renewed Babylonian Empire. The rise of Babylon has been in the news a lot more since the 1980s, since Saddam Hussein began rebuilding the ancient city of Babylon. Of course, his whole efforts were all thwarted in the early 90s with the whole Gulf War and all of that. But what it's done is it's brought really Old Testament backgrounds, Old Testament survey, and biblical prophecy into focus more in our day. Of course, we know Babylon is there in the Old Testament. If you remember in Daniel chapter 2, we see this phenomenal vision that Daniel has, or that Nebuchadnezzar has, and Daniel's able to interpret. Free Bible Images is doing a very effective job of putting these things into pictures. So I'm going to show you some of the pictures from them. This is what Nebuchadnezzar sees. A multi-image statue. A huge, huge statue. And he has no idea what it means. He could see that the different parts of the statue have different materials. What do you notice about the materials? What do you notice about the materials in terms of value? When you look at the statue, it's a decreasing value because the head is a head of gold. Okay, what else do you notice about them in terms of stability?
Again, decreasing.
Is it decreasing stability?
Yes.
Would iron be more stable or less stable than gold? Well, at least stronger.
Stronger.
Okay, so the kingdoms become, you might say, less valuable, but stronger. That's kind of how life is. The structure for this building here was not made out of gold. This building would be very, very expensive if all the pilings and all that was gold instead of cement with rebar, with steel, you know. Of course, Nebuchadnezzar himself, or more accurately, the nation of Babylon is the head. It was the most opulent, which is quite a bit when you realize that the Persians who followed had huge, amazing opulence in the book of Esther. We see that. But gold is obviously the most valuable commodity we have today. People buy gold because it's so valuable. Silver is also quite valuable, but not nearly as much. My wife and I were reading Esther, and it struck me how Haman offered to pay 10,000 bags of silver for the privilege of eradicating the Jews. That was his bribe to the king. A lot of silver. Bronze, then, in terms of the waste and the bronze and hips or thighs or whatever, is then, well, by the way, we're going to only study gold and silver in this course because the Old Testament ends with silver. It ends in this Medo-Persian era. And then after that, the bronze represents the people of Greece. And that's more properly New Testament backgrounds. So you'll see, if you want to continue on your own pace, you're welcome to go and look at the teaching and all that based on Greece and then also on Rome that we have in New Testament backgrounds. I won't be teaching you New Testament foundations. One of the other professors is going to teach you that. So maybe we'll cover that there. And then finally, we get down to the feet that do have iron. The feet have iron in them, but also mixed with clay. And this is depicting partial Roman, but partial also very insecure, and including the 10 toes, which correlates with many other things in Daniel and Revelation, that I think is still referring to a revived Roman Empire yet ahead. But we're not going to talk about Rome. Daniel sees what the king cannot see, though. Daniel sees the meaning of the vision. And he realizes that the rock that's hewn out of the mountain and goes and smashes the the statue, the feet of the statue, what does it actually smash? What does it actually destroy?
The base foundation.
It destroys the foundation, but does it only destroy the foundation? You see that the foundation is destroyed because that last kingdom is going to be destroyed by Christ, who's going to replace it with his own kingdom after that. This is one of the reasons I am pre-millennial, because this the kingdom of Christ comes and destroys that kingdom, and then not only that kingdom, but all the other kingdoms are destroyed as well. When you think about it, the implications are quite far-reaching. That means that these various kingdoms, to some extent, are still with us today. And I trust that as we go through this session on the Babylonians, you'll see that a lot of what the Babylonians did is actually with us today. That hasn't been destroyed. Especially the religious system. What we find among the Persians in their administrative system, very much with us today. What we know about the Greeks, Greek language, Greek culture, Greek emphasis on philosophy, sports, very much with us today. And certainly the Roman might, the Roman army, a rule by, you know, the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, it meant you destroy all your enemies, that's how you bring peace.
Amen.
That kind of concept is certainly with us here today as well. And Daniel chapter 2 gives us actually a foretaste of the four kingdoms to come from his perspective, two of which we'll look at now, two of which are more background to the New Testament, that is the Greeks and the Romans. So we're not going to cover that. But I'm grateful to Free Bible Images and others that I partner with for these sort of things that allow me to put their stuff up. Babylon, we'll look at today in terms of its history, in terms of Babylonian society, how they related to Israel, and then how it relates to us. And it actually starts with Genesis chapter 10. And so I would invite you to turn to Genesis 10. And I want you to meet with your just one person next to you and answer these four questions here. Here's the first time the word Babylon is mentioned in the Bible. And I think God's spoken clearly about this, so we should take the origin of Babel from what the Scripture says and not have to go to all the scholars and who say have these various ideas as to where it actually began, because Genesis 10 is quite clear about that. So how did it start? What motivated this beginning? What resulted from its founding? And then what did Babylon signify? All right, let me just give you a couple of minutes. You can talk with the person next to you and see if you can get those questions answered in your group, okay? No more than three, just two or three of you gathering together, okay? So get somebody close by. Yeah, you guys can talk. Three of you together. If you're listening on the website, I would encourage you also to answer these questions, because it can be interactive for you as well to think through what these various things would be. How did it start? Thank you. what I'm hoping everyone will discover is that this came about through a desire for self-worship. Where we have to recognize that actually, when we are involved in idolatry, we are actually Genesis 10. Genesis 10, 8 to 10. I hope you're looking it up on your own. Sounds like some of you are already over to Revelation, so don't worry about a Revelation passage, but that's good. It's good to help get into that. But tell me some of the answers you've got to these questions, all right? So how did it start? Who was the leader?
Nimrod.
Nimrod. And what was his occupation, you might say?
Hunter.
Why would a hunter be so insignificant? It would be so significant. Why was he so significant being a hunter?
Because
he was mighty. Yeah. He was a mighty. What was he hunting?
People.
It doesn't say here. Normally, you don't have a hunter who's hunting people. We call that a warrior, you know. We call that a soldier or something like that. I don't think he would have been so significant because, oh, he went around and killed everybody. Isn't that wonderful, you know? There must have been some kind of proliferation, let's say, of wild animals in this day that were really threatening people. And people they felt that there was a security in gathering themselves in cities. That would have been helpful. Obviously, people gathered in cities and put walls around them as a protective feature. That's not offensive. That's defensive. And so perhaps we're looking at after the Ice Age, or perhaps we're looking at many wild animals around. And he ends up really providing a sense of security for the people. So in that sense, it's a good thing, right? In fact, it's proverbial. The man is like Nimrod, the greatest hunter in the world. You know, that became a proverb of their day. So what motivated this beginning? A sense of
security.
A sense of security, not a bad thing, right? What resulted from Babylon being founded, though? Pride, very much so. And the pride came about because not only did he build Babylon, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh. Does that sound a little familiar? Akkad? Yeah, we studied the Akkadians. And so the Akkadian roots actually go back to Nimrod and the people that were with him. From there, he expanded the territory to Syria, building the cities of Nineveh, Rehoboth-ur, Calah, and Rezin. Remember we studied the, the great city of Nineveh, which was a configuration of four cities and a pyramid, that all goes back to Nimrod. An amazing thing to see a man who was able to establish this many cities. He was a very powerful, very influential man. But what then did Babylon signify then as a result from all of this? I don't know if you can see it there, but you do see it when you get to Revelation 17. What did you find in Revelation 17, those of you who are able to go there, as it's looking back to this? So what would this prostitute be representative of?
Unfaithfulness to God.
Unfaithfulness. We often think of a prostitute being someone who's unmarried. That's kind of a more of a modern idea, I think. I mean, back then, a lot of prostitutes were married. And the idea is that she's not faithful to her husband. You know? So how would that relate to Babylon? The people had the truth of God, right? But they weren't following the truth of God. They got away from God and they got involved in what the scripture often calls spiritual adultery. So idolatry is probably the best depiction you can, what spiritual adultery is actually talking about. When you have the knowledge of God and yet you go and worship idols. This is what we find in Hosea and other places of the Old Testament that refer to spiritual adultery. So idolatry or false worship that comes about through all of this is a way of honestly worshiping ourselves. You know, if you go worship an idol made of wood or stone or gold or whatever, are you really worshiping these things? Idols, are you really worshiping the idol itself? I had a talk with a young man who came to my church last month, who I read to him some of the passages from He's a Buddhist, and a 17-year-old, and I read them some of the passages from Isaiah that says, why do people take a piece of wood, chop it in half? Half of it they use to warm themselves at the fire, and the other half they carve into an idol and bow down and worship. Doesn't that sound a little silly? I didn't want to use the word silly. I didn't want to be offensive to him, but that doesn't make sense to me. Can you help me understand that? And he said, we don't really worship the wood. We worship the God that the wood is standing for. And I said, but that God doesn't actually have any claim on your life, does he? He doesn't actually say anything to you. The wood doesn't speak back. The stone doesn't speak back to you. So, is not idolatry really worshiping oneself, exalting oneself? I don't know if you've thought about this before. This is the kind of things that have been stirring in my mind recently as I thought about idolatry and been teaching a lot about the Old Testament. If you're going to worship something that doesn't give you any feedback, any criticism, then you really have no accountability at all. You are your own God, so to speak. And Nimrod represents that. He got the people's acclaim because he did some very helpful things for society. But Babylon ended up becoming the place where false worship really started. Do we have any idolatry preceding Genesis 10? Not that I can recall. Can you think of any? Not specifically mentioned there. So Babylon has a huge impact on how we actually look at life. Any of your thoughts? Any other thoughts? Now, as we get into the city of Babylon, the name, where do we get the name Babylon from? Babel. Which, and Babel means? It means to speak without any real communication. That's what the people experienced after the Tower of Babel. They were talking, but people didn't really understand what they're talking about. The location of Babel was on the plain of Shinar. Yes. And Babel actually goes back to the Tower of Babel because Genesis 10 fits in chronologically after Genesis 11. All right? We have many, many different peoples who had that area, occupied that area from antiquity. In the traditional reckoning going back to 3200 BC, I don't know if it really goes back that far, unless my chronology might be off. But in any case, we normally think of the old Babylonian Empire, 1830 to 1531. Do you remember the most popular king of the old Babylonian Empire? We'll study him later on when we get into legal literature. His name was Hammurabi, or Hammurapi, with a B or a P at the end. He was the first one to codify laws. Instead of just speak these laws, actually write them down and try to be very objective about this. But after him, this area had all kinds of different people conquering it and reconquering it. So we normally think of the Neo-Babylonian, very, very short-lived empire at the end of the Old Testament history. 625 with the father of Nebuchadnezzar. So the Neo-Babylonian empire began with Nabopolassar, who ruled for 20 years. And then his son, Nebuchadnezzar, ruled for much more than that. But after Nebuchadnezzar, after he is deposed in 568, we have about, 5 different kings ruling only in about 20 years or so, 20 or 30 years. So it crumbled very quickly, even though it was very, very glorious, which is exactly what the Daniel 2 image is talking about. So he is the key man, Nebuchadnezzar, of this Neo-Babylonian Empire. He is the one that God used for Jerusalem's fall. And here's the irony of it. Babylon, the place of the greatest idolatry the world's ever known, was God's instrument to destroy Judah for its idolatry. Yeah. Do you catch the irony there? God takes this people that were just so idolatrous, and he uses them as his instrument to conquer the southern kingdom of Judah because they were so idolatrous. And he raised up many prophets at that time. Habakkuk and Joel, I believe. Jeremiah, Daniel, Ezekiel. Lamentations laments the fall of Jerusalem during this Babylonian era. And various prophets were raised up by God. 5 of them I can see here to be used of God at this particular point. When the people come back to the land, this is after the fall of Babylon, and this is the rise of the next kingdom, which is called the which kingdom? Persian kingdom. Yeah, the Medes and the Persians together. And this is a very turbulent time when Daniel and Ezekiel were ministering. Josiah was the last of the good kings who gets killed in 609 by Pharaoh Necho of Egypt, who's making his way on up past Israel, going through Israel to fight the Babylonians. And Josiah intercepts Pharaoh out of the plan of God. And even though he's a godly king, he made a fatal mistake there, literally fatal. And he ended up dying. And his dynasty, the ones who came from him, were the last 4 kings, either his brothers or his son or grandson. And the kingdom did not last much longer after him. We actually have the Babylonians be used of God to be the ones who kept the people away from the land for 70 years. God said that the land was supposed to rest for 70 years, the land of Israel, because every seventh year they weren't supposed to be, you know, farming. It's quite a gracious provision, isn't it? I mean, wouldn't you love to have a job like that? You work for 6 years, and then the seventh year,
1 year holiday.
1 year holiday. Nothing to do for a whole year. The crops will still come up. But don't worry about them. God says, when you do that, the sixth year, I'll give you not twice as much, but I'll give you three times as much crop. See, God knew whether they would rest the seventh year, right? So he knew if they were going to rest that seventh year, he'd give them three times the sixth year. So they had plenty of food for the seventh year that would bring them all the way into the next seven-year cycle. 70 times they were unfaithful to do that over these hundreds of years that the kingdom was there. So God said, that land needs rest. That land is so tired. You guys have not given that land rest. I'm going to give the land rest 70 years. You can see this in the last few verses of 2 Chronicles where the Lord explains this. And so he takes the people out of the land, and don't worry about memorizing all these dates here, but these are significant dates where God says, I'm taking the people out of the land because the people are the problem. They're the ones not giving the land rest. I guess you could say maybe in a sense God gave the people rest because they were, I don't know if he could say that, but I don't know if a passage that says that. But anyway, the people were away from the land from the time that Daniel was taken, 605, for 70 years. They were actually not back until they were restored to the land under the Persians, 536. That's about 70 years. There's also another 70-year exile, and that is called the temple exile, because the temple was destroyed in 586. And even though they had started rebuilding the temple right around 539, 538, they actually didn't get it finished because of opposition until 516. So that's a second 70-year exile. So when you talk about 70-year exiles, you can actually figure it one of two different ways. And in the Babylonian desire to conquer Israel, that's something that became very much a part of, you could say, modern Iraqi culture. And it was Saddam Hussein's goal to be the new Nebuchadnezzar. This was very evident in the 1986 medallion they had at the Babylon International Festival, because the two look exactly alike on the medallion. Saddam Hussein, he even has the same nose as Nebuchadnezzar here. He's just lacking the beard. They basically look exactly the same. He wanted to be known as the new Nebuchadnezzar who would conquer Israel. And yet we find over and over and over throughout history, those who rise up to conquer the Jews end up themselves getting conquered. I mean, how many times do we have to go through this over and over again? God's going to protect his people. Even in the last 100 years, you know, Hitler tried to eradicate the Jews. He got eradicated. Saddam tried to do the same thing. He got eradicated. Go back through all the centuries. God said in Genesis 12:3, I will bless those who bless you. I will curse those who curse you. And you look around the world today, the countries that are the greatest in opposition to Israel are the ones that are struggling the most. The countries that bless Israel are actually countries that are prosperous. We happen to be in one of them. Don't happen to be there, but... And I don't hear anybody really talk about the reason for Singapore prospering so much is because of the camaraderie and the support that Singapore has given to Israel. But I really believe it's true. Because, I mean, that's what the scripture says. And it's the same for my country. The times when my country has turned its back on Israel have been times of disunity and difficulty. And actually, things have turned around very, very significantly since the U.S. has reaffirmed commitment to Israel, even moving the embassy over to Israel. Did you know that in the last year and 9 months, that the stock market in the U.S. has hit 100 new records? Did you know that? If you listen to BBC or CNN, you'll never hear it. But this is the most prosperous time that the U.S. has had in recent history. Unemployment rates for black Americans is the lowest ever in U.S. history. Unemployment rates for Hispanics, the lowest ever in U.S. history. I think with a renewal of commitment to Israel, there is a corresponding blessing of God that should not surprise any of us, actually. So the Babylonians are the ones who are the rising power at the reign of Josiah. And I won't get into all the details and explain all of these, but the last four kings after him are the ones that actually lead finally to Josiah's son Zedekiah, who is the last of the kings. And this all occurs during the time of the Babylonians. So let's look at a little bit on geography and how that might impact things here. Babylon itself is the name of the city. Babylonia then would be the region surrounding it. And it was right there on the Euphrates River. But the impact and the influence of the Babylonian Empire went up to the Tigris River and basically covered all of Mesopotamia, the land in between the river. It's a great climate. This is ideal for trade because it's on the Fertile Crescent. People could travel that whole time. It was a very, very prosperous time. In recent days, this whole area is also turning its back against Israel, and there's a huge drought going on there right now. There are dams on the Euphrates River, and the Turks have actually been cutting off water to Iraq, and there's not enough water in the Fertile Crescent presently today. Because of these sort of things, you can do a Google search on it and you'll see it. But the city of Babylon was basically the height of ancient civilization. There was no other city that compared to Babylon in terms of its opulence, in terms of its money. It was considered to be the height of them all. And yet, it was also the most idolatrous city. Babylon had many gods. They never thought they had too many gods. They took in Sumerian gods, Akkadian gods. You got a god, you want to import a god into our society? Fine, go for it. Key of them all, the most revered of them was Marduk. And Marduk was considered the strongest of the gods. You read about this when you read about Marduk killing Tiamat, you know, and the whole world actually coming into being through the dividing of Tiamat's body, half of which became the land, half of which became the sea. And so worship of Marduk was paramount. You have the temples to all kinds of them, but the one in the middle was the temple of Marduk, right in the center of the city, next to the Babylon, next to the Euphrates River. By the way, that Euphrates River is no longer there. It has shifted way over here, over to the east. But in any case, that's how rivers shift over the ages. And worship of Marduk was there, of course, there at the main temple in the middle of the city. But there are also other gods. Shamash, the sun god, in charge of justice. Ishtar. Maybe you've heard of the Ishtar Gate. That was the entrance, the main entrance into Babylon. The goddess of war and love. Anu, God of the heavens, Enlil, God of the lands, A, God of wisdom and magic, Sin, the moon god. This one makes its way on over toward Israel as well. Adad, the weather god. He was the weatherman, ancient weatherman. And, of course, they were worshiping all these various gods for the based upon their fears, you know. So if you kind of look at a city, the city map, where were the gods? You know, you can see they're everywhere. the temple of Adad, the temple of Ishtar in the middle. Basically, throughout this whole city, you've got all these major gods. This is Enlil Gate, Shamash Gate. Everything's pretty much named after gods here. And then the temples and the rituals come about as a result of this. 53 temples in Babylon. 53 temples. You say, wow, that's amazing. How many temples are there in Singapore?
India got a lot. So
from India, though, from an Indian standpoint, you think Singapore doesn't have that many good temples. Maybe compared to your city, maybe that's true. I can't say. 55 chapels just of Marduk alone. 300 chapels for earthly deities. 600 for heavenly deities. That'll cover them all, right? Not if you're Hindu, because there's millions of heavenly deities, right? 180 altars for the goddess Ishtar. 180 for the gods Nergal and Adad. 12 altars for other different gods. So you add them all up, you've got at least over 1,000 different temples there.
India got 30 million gods and goddesses.
Oh, we just can't compete with India, Shiva. Yeah, we can't compete. 30 million, yeah. I don't think the Babylonians had 30 million. Yeah, okay. Okay, you win. But from a biblical perspective, it's not actually dealing with India and Hinduism. You don't have Hinduism coming up. Well, I know the Hindus say Hinduism has an undated past. No one actually knows when Hinduism actually began, but
even they themselves don't know.
Right. But Revelation 17:5 says Babylon, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. Think of that title. This is talking about end times Babylon. It's referring back to this Babylon here. Not only is Babylon a prostitute, she's a mother of all prostitutes. That's the worst of them all, right? And the mother of the abominations of the earth. All that you find that is abominable, Revelation 17 says that this is looking back at that Babylon and referring to the future Babylon. They had all these various rituals. They had all these various temples. I'm only talking about Babylon here, but if you could go through the various cities of Babylonia, you'll see that each one had its own god, its own temple, land, slaves, priests, charms, etc. There were also personal idols. Each Babylonian citizen had a personal god. Now, that's not a personal relationship with God. That is a personal idol. So it's no wonder why Revelation looks back at Babylon and says, wow, this place is the mother of all the abominations of the world. Individuals could make their special requests of their god, their little god, and the ziggurats were these huge stepped structures that are found throughout Babylon. The medieval depiction of it, it was mostly looking more like a medieval architecture. You really have got the ziggurats all over. We know pretty clearly that they look more like ziggurats, not some tower in the way that we would think of a tower. In fact, we don't even have these tall buildings that we have right now, taller than, what, 5 stories, I guess, until the invention of steel in the last 200 years. There's So Isaiah says, Babylon, the jewel of the kingdoms, the glory of the Babylonians' pride will be overthrown by God like Sodom and Gomorrah. We're still trying to find Sodom and Gomorrah. We have some ideas. One of my friends is a scholar who's done some work on that. She'll be never inhabited or lived in through all generations, but desert creatures will lie there. Jackals will fill her houses. There, the owls will dwell. Hyenas will howl in her strongholds, jackals in her luxurious palaces. If I could put it in modern language, it'd be saying, Singapore is going to be overthrown. Orchard Road, which is the third most expensive place to rent business property in the world, will be occupied by jackals. Shenton Way, with its 129 banks, the banking center for Southeast Asia, will have hyenas going through its buildings, raising their young there. I mean, if you can imagine Marina Bay with all its beautiful buildings there, will all be absolute ruins. And people will have a hard time finding it in the days to come. And no one will ever live there again. This is what God is actually saying about them. We know their literature was immersed in Sumerian culture. They had a formal education. We'll have a session on education later in terms of how people actually learned back then. And I've already mentioned that that cuneiform came from this area, named from the cuneus, the wedge, that showed etchings in the clay for their language. And so we have a pictorial script that actually developed into a very simpler script. So you're not actually drawing a picture, but you're making little etchings, similar to what we find with Chinese. But Chinese is a lot more complicated than what we've got here. And this impact of Sumeria impacts, Aramaic and Greek became the common languages later on after this time. But pretty significant in its own time. Their poetry was pretty complicated, and I won't get into all the details there. You've read some of it in Numa Elish and Gilgamesh Epic. They're known for their music. We studied the Babylonian version of the flood and compared it to the biblical account. We haven't looked too much on wisdom literature, but they also had a theodicy. How do you explain the existence of evil? This is something that all societies have to really wrestle with. We have the Marduk prophecy that was actually written after the event, deemed to be prophecy, trying to get more people to worship Marduk. And this is this has led some biblical scholars to think that the Bible is actually doing the same thing. But we have to take each of these based on their own merits. The second election of the European Parliament a generation ago, was in the 80s or so, depicted the European Parliament as a woman sitting on a beast, believe it or not. Similar to what we find in Revelation 17, which maybe shouldn't be too surprising, because when we're talking about Revelation 17, we're talking about the reign of Domitian, and these kinds of images, the Roman Empire would be a key figure for looking to what will happen in the days ahead. We see this image in Daniel. We see the image of the feet of clay and iron mixed. But the Babylonian mystery religion that we find there, as I noted earlier, actually appears today. There are some books that have been written about this. Ralph Widrow, his book, Babylon Mystery Religion, is actually updated. Dave Hunt, A Woman Rides the Beast, chronicle many of the teachings of Babylon mystery religion and how they actually show up today. Take, for example, mother and child worship. The goddess Semiramis held her child Tammuz in her arms. And we find Tammuz mentioned when, even in the time of Jeremiah, where Jews were weeping over Tammuz. Here they were worshiping the gods of Babylon. And God said, you like the gods of Babylon? I'll let the Babylonians come and conquer you. That's exactly what happened. But we find this whole concept of worshiping the mother and her child in Egypt. We find it in Greece. We find that Buddhists and Hindus, all of them have some form of mother and son worship.
Even Roman Catholics, they worship mother and son.
She was called the Queen of Heaven. So as I noted, Jeremiah 7, these women who were conquered by the Babylonians said, oh, the reason we were conquered by the Babylonians is because we stopped making cakes of bread for the Queen of Heaven. And Jeremiah responds back, no, it's because you were making cakes for the Queen of Heaven that God judged you. They didn't get the picture even afterwards.
Yes.
And we find the same thing today, where we have a worship of Mary with her son Jesus in the Babylonian fashion. I've been in Rome at St. Peter's and seen this absolutely amazing piece of architecture of Mary with her son Jesus. But where's the focal point? When you look at this, who's facing forward? Mary? Whose face is turned away? Who's larger? Mary, do you think Mary was larger than her son? Do you think Michelangelo left his ruler at home that day when he was planning this?
No.
Michelangelo was one of the best sculptors of human history.
Yeah.
He knew exactly what he was doing. Why would he depict Mary as larger than Jesus, except that maybe Mary was larger than Jesus in his own worship? We find Babylonian mystery religion brought on into the Catholic Church through the obelisks, 90 feet by 9 feet, going from Daniel 2 into Daniel 3. Nebuchadnezzar says, you need to worship this whole statue. 90 feet high. That's like a 9-story building. And 9 feet wide. We find actually that this obelisk in St. Peter's is not a replica of the obelisk of sun worship that had gone from Babylon to Egypt. It's the exact one that was brought by Caligula around AD 40 from the Egyptian temple of sun worship. And you can see it today, the Egyptian obelisk at St. Peter's Square. It's Babylonian worship that's brought into Egyptian worship that's brought over to Rome and now brought over to my country, because the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C. has the exact same features. There are many, many other pagan parallels between the Babylonians and Catholics that have been brought into our own thinking today by millions and millions of people. The idea of relics, you know, a portion related to, you know, the Catholics have this whole idea, especially in the Middle Ages, they were selling these little pieces of wood they said came from the cross. Somebody figured once that if you added up all those little pieces of wood that they sold, you could make several houses with those pieces of wood. Made an enormous amount of money. The idea of pilgrimages, going back to your origin, and you get special blessings doing that, the Catholics have adopted from the Babylonians. Indulgences, where you could pay for someone else or pay for your own forgiveness. Purgatory, where we go not to heaven or hell, we go to some other place, which raises up all kinds of issues. How do I get people out of purgatory? And it has enabled people to take advantage of the untaught. Pontiffs, celibate priests who don't marry, transubstantiation, where you actually eat the bread and the and drink the wine, but no, you're actually eating the body and you're drinking the blood of your God. Even Easter and the winter festival of Christmas have leanings that come back all the way to Babylon. It's good for us to know these sort of things happen, and we can be careful of what might be pagan in our own celebration.
Protestantism also came out of that.
Protestantism came out of it came out of Catholicism, and it in many ways denied these things, but in some areas it has some overlap. Yeah, but especially indulgences was the key thing that actually led to the Protestant Revolution, Reformation. Well, there are many more things to be said, but we're out of time, and I just want you to catch that this stuff is actually very, 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 very real. And the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, the opulence and all that, we see all that kind of stuff still today. The materialism of Babylon, these are the kinds of things that impact us today. Let me go to slide 76 and just finish with this little cartoon. What you doing here, kid? Ah, just enjoying God's creation, she says. Have you ever seen God? Nope. And he says, then how do you know that he even exists? She says, I just know. It's called faith. And his response is, well, it must take an incredible faith to believe in a God you can't see. Not really. That takes incredible faith, she says. To bow down to something that you know that you actually have created of your own hands takes incredible faith. And it's a good reminder to us not to have any idols, whether American idols or any other kind of idols, you know? Because all of this, trust and riches and glory and wealth and self-determination, all these sort of things make their way to us today. We can experience it in democracy and capitalism and materialism today. It's a good caution for us. May it not be so in your life and mine.